All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace, and today I'm joined by John Paul. This is an X-Men Tuesday episode, so we're going to be talking about a couple of X-Men books, namely Uncanny X-Men number 11, and the first book that kicked off the Age of X-Men universe, if you will, in terms of the limited series. Obviously, we had the Age of X-Men Alpha that sort of introduced us to the world that was created at the end of X-Men Disassembled. I know, John Paul, you weren't able to join me for that episode. So I'm curious, before we get started talking about these two books, what did you think? Did you read Age of X-Men Alpha? I mean, you must have, right? I know you're a big X-Men fan.
Yeah, I read it when it came out. It's been a while, so some stuff might have seeped through the cracks, so to speak. But yeah, I read it when it came out. I never completed the entire series because there was a lot of splinters off into different books, but I did read it.
Yeah, so I'm curious your thoughts. So when I read it, I'm like, okay, well, you can't help but think of, all right, Age of X-Men, clearly Marvel was going for kind of some nostalgia from the Age of Apocalypse, which was an event back in the 90s, an X event that was wildly popular. That's where X-Man himself, that's where his origins lay. He came out of that kind of alternate universe, alternate storyline. We had other X-Men ideas or storylines or plot threads, if you will, that, you know, we still see repercussions to this day. Dark Beast is another one that kind of came out of that. So obviously, like, super popular, people still remember it fondly. So I can't help but think this Age of X-Men event that Marvel did was, okay, well, let's go back and kind of mine those story ideas and kind of that same story structure and universe structure again. Age of Apocalypse was very much, for lack of a better term, post-apocalyptic. Like, what if Apocalypse won? He took over the world. Everything is kind of shattered in pieces, and, you know, it's not a nice world. It's not a good place to be. This Age of X-Men is sort of the exact opposite, right? Like, everybody's a mutant. Everybody has special power. Like, literally everybody that's born is going to be a mutant someday. The X-Men are revered as heroes and saviors. There's no more war. There's no more famine. Diseases are, you know, few and far between. But they seem to be paying a price for this utopia, which is kind of the way with utopias when we see them in stories. There's a degree of fascism involved. There's a degree of you've given up your freedom. You've given up your individuality. In order to have this, you know, perfect world, if you will. It certainly doesn't seem very perfect to me. We saw in Age of Alpha a few things that were pretty fascist, were pretty terrifying. There's no more, like, relationships. We see that. We'll talk a little bit about that in Marvel's X-Men 1. There's no more relationships. There's no more, like, physical contact. That kind of thing has gone out the window. And there's not really the freedom of choice with kind of what you want to do with your life. Everybody, it's almost communism in a way, right? Everybody's out for the greater good. So when you were reading X-Men Age of Alpha, did those things, like, strike you? Did they resonate with you? And what were your thoughts about them? Do you think, oh, this is what it takes to have a world where mutants can live and not be persecuted? Or did the alarm bell start going off? You're like, oh, this is not good. What did you think? I think you might still be on mute.
Well, there's whole, yeah, sorry about that. Okay. There's a whole too good to be true vibe from the start. What I really did pick up, it felt like Truman Show. That movie popped out to me immediately. It's like everything's all nice and good, but there's got to be something underneath it because utopias can't really exist when there's bunch of imperfect people within them, right? So
yeah, there's always more beneath the surface. So yeah, I kind of felt the same way. And if you want more thoughts on my Age of Un Age of X-Men Alpha, what I thought about reading it. Go back and listen to that episode. So let's go ahead and dive into Age of X-Men, Marvelous X-Men, which is the series. I think there were five or six different series, and they focused on different X-Men characters. So, you know, we had one that focused on Apocalypse. We have one that focuses on kind of the younger X-Men. This one is the one that focuses on kind of the traditional X-Men. We've got Colossus, we've got Storm, we've got X-23, we've got Nightcrawler, Jean Grey. Also, Magneto is thrown in there, X-Man himself. And then Nature Girl, who I wasn't really familiar with before this, but I don't think she's a new character to this. I think she's been around. And then, we had the Age of X-Men Prisoner, which was the one that focused on Bishop and what happens to him after the events of Age of X-Men Alpha. So this, if you're only going to read one of the spin-off series, this is probably the one. The Marvelous X-Men is the one you want to read because it has X-Man in it, and it probably follows along most closely with kind of what goes on. Or you can just get, Marvel Unlimited, and then you can, you know, have access to all of them. They're all on there these days. So Age of X-Man, Marvelous X-Men number one, is written by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler. The art is by Marco Faia, I think it is. It's F-A-I-L-L-A, so I'm giving it the Hispanic pronunciation with the double L sounding like a Y. Matt Milla, who I don't think he's Hispanic, so I'll go with Milla for him, but it could be Matt Mia, not sure. He does the color work. And then we've got letters by Joe Caramagna. Cover artist is Phil Noto. There's variants by Victor Hugo, In-Huck Lee, Carlos Pacheco, Rafael Fontarez, and Nolan Woodward. So it starts off where we get a quick blurb. It talks about, like I said, the Age of X-Man world. Welcome to a perfect world. Everybody's a mutant. Everybody's special. Everybody's powerful. There's no more strife. There's no more oppression. It's that dream that X-Man had made real, and it's a dream that must be protected at any cost. So we're introduced to the Marvelous X-Men, that lineup I told you about: Colossus, Storm, Magneto, Nature Girl, X-23, Nightcrawler, Jean Grey, and X-Men. And they're the planet's first line of defense. They are the Justice League, if you will, the Avengers of this universe, and they're using their abilities to keep the world safe, and they're beloved. And that supposedly is as it should be. So it starts off, and we're seeing that each of the X-Men has their own home. We see Colossus, who only has part of one of his arms. His left arm has been removed or cut off, or he's lost it in some way, right above the elbow. But we see each of them, Colossus, Storm, Magneto, Nature Girl, Nightcrawler, X-23, Jean Grey, and X-Man himself. And the overarching theme here is that everybody still works together. They're still friends. They still work to protect each other as a group. And this is all, we gain all this information by a voiceover from X-Men himself. But he says, I know better than anyone, even in the most crowded rooms, even with the thoughts of 1,000 people in your head, you're always alone. I don't know that I agree with that. That could be sort of the perspective that X-Man is coming from, just based on the life that he's had, the experiences he's had, being, you know, basically created in a lab and being alone and not having not having grown up with love and nurturing environment and that sort of thing. So even in a crowded room, even if he's reading the thoughts of everyone on the planet, he always feels alone. And I think because of that, that's kind of why we see the world the way that it is. Yes, there is some degree of truth to what he says. We're always alone in our own thoughts and in our own heads. But what the problem with the world that X-Men has created here, and he says it himself, he says, the only difference is in this new era, we embrace it. We embrace that loneliness. And as the camera pulls back on this, He continues to say, from coworkers to teams to countries to races to nations, every human group has always been comprised of secluded island universes, right? Like everybody is alone. Again, he goes back to that. I don't agree with that. I think what makes us human and what makes society work is the connections and the relationships. But again, from his perspective, everybody's always been alone, no matter what relationships you might have. And in his world, his perfect utopia he's created, they've come to embrace that isolation. And he says, when we accept isolation, we become the world. And when it pulls all the way back, you see that it's a cul-de-sac, and each one of these marvelous X-Men has their own giant house. It's formed in a circle. They all have fences up between every single house, as well as a fence between each of their yards that faces the cul-de-sac with gates. And so they're all separated. Here they have this supposed utopia, this supposed perfect world, but they're all isolated. They're all alone. And to me, that's not a way to foster relationships and society. But again, it's a warning sign that this world that X-Men has created may not be all it's cracked up to be. But he does go on to say that, yes, we accept isolation. We become the world, and in turn, the world becomes our tribe, and we do whatever it takes to protect this dream. Now, in the middle of this cul-de-sac where all their individual X-mansions are, there's some loudspeakers. An alarm goes off, says, X-Men, your action is required, and they all head to the X-Sanctuary, which is a giant building where they all gather to basically be briefed on threats that could be impacting the world that X-Men has created. And we see a sign over the door to this X-Sanctuary that says, Identity, Autonomy, Harmony. Which I kind of like that idea. Everybody should have their own individual identity. You should have autonomy. You know, you should be able to make decisions for your own life. And obviously, you want to live in harmony. One thing that becomes apparent, especially when you start reading later series, especially Next Gen, which talks about kind of the training these mutants receive as they're growing up, it's that autonomy question. Do they really have autonomy? Do they really have freedom? I mean, from according to Next Gen, which we'll talk about in the next X-Men Tuesday episode, they don't really have autonomy in terms of what they're assigned to. They're assigned to either kind of the police force, the agricultural side, the historical side, or the health medical side. So I don't know that autonomy, it doesn't quite fit. It's there and it's a good idea, but I don't think in practice that it really exists in this world. Anyway, when the X-Men get inside, they find out that there's a forest fire that it's threatening to consume Los Angeles. It's encroaching upon Cerebro West, which apparently there's different Cerebros. You almost think of Cerebro as a training / medical type facility. It's where mutants are now grown. Because again, remember I mentioned no physical contact, so we'll get into that a little bit. So the X-Men say, okay, we've got to get there as fast as we can. It appears some people have already been displaced. The fire is spreading. So they need to get there and try to save as many people as they can. So they show up to Los Angeles, California. Nature Girl's talking about how the trees are screaming, and she takes Colossus with her to go and try to rescue the wildlife. And for Nature Girl, that goes beyond just the animals, trying to save as many plants as possible. Meanwhile, X-Man and Storm try to contain the fire from above, and Nightcrawler, X-23, Jean Grey, and Magneto go into Cerebro West and try to evacuate people from the building as fast as they can. So we're told there's a nursery of kids there, and they've got to rescue them. And then X-23 heads into a place called the Pod Hatchery. And meanwhile, there's a plane overhead that was supposed to land in Los Angeles. It's having trouble because of the near visibility of Zero from the smoke, and they're requesting some diversion. So X-Man is trying to save them while we see Colossus and Nature Girl save as many animals as possible. Back to X-23 in the hatchery, and we see that, kind of like the Matrix, human beings are no longer born created through physical contact. They're created in these pods, these hatcheries. They're literally grown. So right there is a huge red flag for me. It just seems so inhuman. Like, why are you even doing it? In the Matrix, you know, it was because the machines needed power. They needed energy. You know, people were basically Duracell batteries to them. Here, I understand you want to continue to propagate the species. And again, everybody's going to be born with powers. But why so many? Like, how is it determined how many people and they don't have parents? They're just raised in these Cerebro basically compounds, and I'm sure they're given attention and love to some extent, but it's not the same. I don't feel like there would be that same connection that you would have with, you know, being born of a mother and a father. The family unit is just gone. You're guided from birth, apparently, to you know, learn how to use your powers when they manifest and be kind of indoctrinated into this world that you're born into. But again, it's feeding into the idea of isolation. Yeah, you are alone. You don't have the familial connections. And in a way, it makes a lot of sense, right? Because this is basically the way X-Man's childhood was. It's basically the way he was created, but dialed up to 11, right? It's like X-Man's childhood, Nate Summers' childhood on steroids, if you will. He was, you know, hatched in a lab. He wasn't born of, you know, human parents. He took the DNA of Jean Grey and Scott Summers, you know, Marvel Girl and Cyclops, and he was created and born in a lab and, you know, raised by tutors or nursery school attendants, if you will. And so I guess in a way it makes sense that this world that he's created, this supposed utopia, he would follow along in those same sort of footsteps, because he doesn't know any different, right? But you would also think on some level he understands he's the way he is because he didn't have those connections and he wasn't raised in a traditional way, and he wouldn't be making the same mistakes. But when I saw this, and there's hints even, you know, before in the story as you're reading, even before you see this pod hatchery, that this is kind of what the status is, and the way they propagate the species. And right away, like right from the beginning, you start thinking, well, this is not good. At least that's what I thought. What were your thoughts when you saw this pod hatchery and realized that this is the way that I guess they're not human beings, but Homo Superior. This is the way that mutants were being born, grown in a lab. What did you think, John Paul, when you saw that?
Well, it's not just the hatchery, but also the continued messages out of the sound systems of reassurance, but they sound more like indoctrination, like you were saying earlier. You know, everybody is supposed to be safe and happy and all these things and not question it, really. And, you know, you see that in the other parts of the series, like Next Gen, don't question it. But yeah, especially the pod hatchery, I did get that Matrix vibe. And there was another movie called The Island. You ever heard of that one?
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
It was kind of like that too. I got that vibe.
Yeah, that movie, Michael Bay, if I'm not mistaken, people are basically grown in these labs on this island to be like spare parts in case they're clones, basically, and they're spare parts for if their rich, you know, source person like gets in an accident or needs a lung transplant because they smoke or something like that. Yeah, it's along these same lines, and you're right. That's something that didn't jump out at me, but now that you mention it, the loudspeakers that you're talking about. Here they are, these little tiny babies just being fed this propaganda over these loudspeakers. Being alone is harmony. You are gifted. You are in control. You are safe. Everything is good in the world. It's like, man, you're hearing this, you know, as you're growing. So yeah, there's definitely some almost brainwashing, you would say, going on. So it seems to go against a lot of what the X-Men stand for, in a way. You know, here the X-Men want to live in peace. They want to live in harmony. They don't want to be persecuted. And in a way, because of that, almost the underlying theme of Xavier's dream is to have freedom and to have true autonomy, to have the freedom to live your life without being persecuted, without being killed, without being imprisoned, and to be able to make your own choices to live in the world, not to be forced to live on an island of Genosha or wherever. And here, these little babies, right from the start, are not given that same sort of freedom. And what's even worse, in a way, when you think about it, is not only are they not given that freedom because they're indoctrinated so early, they're not even aware, right? They're going to know no different. They're going to be raised in this society that this is the way the world is. They're not even going to really understand what true freedom is. So it's almost, in a way, worse than what regular human beings, you know, Homo sapiens were doing to the mutants in the regular Marvel universe, trying to take their freedom away. At least they knew what it was. Here, they're not even allowed to understand what the concept of freedom is. So in a way, yeah, it's almost worse. So as the story continues, we see that X-23 is trying to evacuate some of the pods, and she gets a little flashback from one of the babies that maybe she had a sister. And she's like, wait, what? Sister? Because again, the familial ties have been completely dissolved in this world. So she's like, what is that? What? I don't understand. Nightcrawler's like, there's so many. Are we going to be able to get them out in time? X-23 responds, hey, we've got to keep trying. We've got to get out as many as we can. Meanwhile, Storm, Nature Girl, and Colossus continue to try to rescue the animals and rein in the damage that's being done. Magneto and Jean Grey are continuing to evacuate people. Magneto is literally holding the building together with his magnetic powers, telling them that the flames have spread too far on the ground floor. Bring everybody up to the roof. Nightcrawler is teleporting as many of the little pod babies out as he can, as fast as he can. And as Jean Grey is trying to evacuate everybody, she gets this message. It's in a blue text, which tells us it's not one of the other X-Men trying to communicate with her. And it basically says, are you tired of being alone? It's okay to love. Trying to kind of foster maybe some sort of dissent in a way. It goes on to say, we can show you the truth. Meanwhile, Jean is affected by this, and she's helped back to her feet by some of the kids that she's trying to evacuate, telling, got to get to the roof, don't stop running. Meanwhile, X-Men shows up to kind of reinforce what Magneto has been doing, and because they can't get all the kids out of the hatchery, X-Men heads there, and he creates a force bubble to protect all the pods that they couldn't get out as the building collapses on top of them, basically. Magneto is able to remove the roof section with everybody that was evacuated there as the building collapses. And then because of the shield that X-Men created, the kids that were still in the pod hatchery that I guess technically haven't been born yet are saved as well. So it looks like the X-Men saved the day. We have some television reporters show up asking if they'd like to comment on today's heroic events. And of course, they say all the right things. Oh, we're just doing our job, you know, protecting mutant kind. We're glad nobody was hurt. And, you know, what's going to happen to the kids? Well, Cerebro South's already agreed to house some of them while we rebuild. And some of them may head to the Summers Institute a few years early, which is basically the new version of school, where X-Men or these kids go for 10 years to train and learn their craft. So feels very strange to have the X-Men praised in this way by the general public and by the media, say the reporter saying, so there you have it, folks, X-Men prevent yet another tragedy. And they're watching that same broadcast later. And Magneto says, this is why I'm proud to be part of an X-Men, and how far we've come since our days of as revolutionaries. And certainly that's the case for Magneto as well. And meanwhile, Jean and Nature Girl are having a conversation. Nature Girl is curious. She says, is it true that mutants used to procreate like other mammals, you know, meaning actual physical contact? And she says, Jean Grey says, by hope's grace, that's not the question I was expecting. And then Nature Girl says, well, can you explain to me what romance is then? And Jean says, well, yeah, it's also another dead idea, similar to families, things we've outgrown as a species. So again, that statement, big warning sign to me. So no physical intimacy, no romance, no family. Those are not ideas that you outgrow. I mean, those are so ingrained to who we are as a species and ingrained into how we survive as a society. Obviously, this society, this Age of X-Men society has done away with those. I feel like that's an abomination in a way. That is who we are as a species. It's how we evolved as you know, living, breathing beings. And I think it's inherent in how we survive and how we'll move forward as a species, no matter how we evolve. I guess maybe in millions of years we could evolve out of that procreation way, and we could evolve, we could you know, propagate our species in a different way. I really don't see that happening, honestly, even in a million years, because it's already been millions of years and this is still the way we do it. And there's so much to be said for emotion and family and ideas of romance and love. Like, the X-Men have always been a family, right? Like, even if they're not, you know, literally flesh and blood, brothers and sisters, it's always felt like a family. They've always wanted to, you know, bend over backwards for each other. And I understand X-Men has created this world where, well, everybody matters now. And whether you have powers or not, everybody has powers here. But, you know, whether or not, and it's an idea of the world as a tribe, as a family. But it's one thing to preach that. It's a lot of lip service. And I don't care how brainwashed you are, in my mind, you're never going to feel as affected or as connected to somebody who is not your own flesh and blood, who you didn't grow up with as your sister or your brother. So we see that X-23 is crying. She is a little out of sorts. And X-Men takes her aside and says, hey, you look like you could use some air. How about a walk? And she says, hey, I saw something back there when I was in the hatchery. I felt pain and torture. And X-Men says, well, you know, if you want, I can take a look inside your head, your thoughts, and I can get a better picture. She says, I'm not really a fan of people digging around in my head. I just need maybe some help to talk about it and sort of get it out. And she says, okay, well, I had this memory. It was very fleeting, but it was something about her. You know, I know it sounds crazy, but I felt like I was seeing a childhood that maybe wasn't mine, and I think I had a sister. But it's all kind of a mess, and you know, I thought I grew up in a place like Cerebro, and the childhood I'm remembering is messy, and people weren't friendly. And X-Men says, no, it's not crazy. I understand exactly how you feel, because our births weren't really all that different from the way these kids are birthed in pods. I'm the product of a cruel, unregulated genetic experiment. I know you were born in the lab before, you know, before the resolution. And X-23 says, I had no idea. And X-Men says, I shouldn't even exist. In a way, I'm an impossibility. I was manufactured in a lab from a timeline that never actually existed, from genetic material of Scott and Jean Grey. And, you know, you were designed to be a weapon just like I was. And X-23 is like, why have we never talked about this? And X-Men goes back to that same old thing that he's been preaching, right? Because that would mean bonding. It would mean getting close. It would mean establishing a relationship. And that means moving away from perfection. So in his mind, people being isolated, people being separated, people being on their own, you know, no matter how many people are in the room, that's perfection? Really? Well, certainly not to me. But again, in this utopia he's created, this is the idea he's preaching. And he goes on to admit to X-23, he says, Laura, the truth is you do have a sister, and her name is Gabby, and just like you, she's a product of James Howlett's DNA, so a clone of Wolverine. And he's like, but I can't let you see her. She does not like that idea. Immediately pops her claws, and he says, hey, stops her with, you know, his thoughts. So this type of recklessness can't be a part of our world, and it's exactly the kind of negativity, you know, I'm trying to eradicate. And I'm sorry, this is bigger than us. We all had to give things up. So it's clear that he's mind wiped her. Again, what kind of freedom is that? You know, he's trying to create this perfect world, but I guess in his mind, well, if you're going to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs. But this is not okay. This goes against everything that Xavier stands for. You can't have a utopia if it means you're mind wiping people. You're removing the connection. Like, in what world does lack of bonding mean that that's perfection? And I get it, right? This is Homo superior. This is not Homo sapien. You know, in the world of Marvel, in the Marvel universe, they are a step beyond, you know, regular human beings. But I don't care. At the end of the day, I think mutants are more human than not, in terms of you need connection, you need family, you need love, you need friendships, you need bonds. And so I don't think it's okay. But in X-Men's mind, we all had to give things up. It's the only way dreams can last. And so the next day we see the X-Men doing what they do, you know, just living in this utopia, oblivious to what they've given up. Storm is tending to her plants. Nature Girl's playing with a bear and a rabbit. X-23 is doing gardening. She's trimming bushes with her claws. Colossus is painting. Nightcrawler's practicing. He's a world famous actor in this world. And Jean's playing with some blocks, look like a Jenga type puzzle. And all of a sudden, she hears that same voice in her head. Are you tired of being alone? It's okay to love. We can show you the truth. And she kind of goes into these convulsions. All the other X-Men come running as Jean starts to speak these words out loud. We can show you the truth. Join our cause. Central Park this Saturday. Embrace the bonds that make life worth living. En Saba Nur will show you the way. Well, En Saba Nur, that's Apocalypse. That's his given name. So clearly, Apocalypse seems to be leading some sort of resistance. And Jean kind of comes out of it. She says, I intercepted a psychic signal, some kind of rallying cry. And apparently they saw a flyer that had these same words on it. And we saw that ourselves in X-Men Age of Alpha. And Jean says, there's a resistance forming. And Storm's like, well, what could they possibly be resisting? And Jean says, us, our way of life, individualism. I don't know what she means by individualism, because they all seem to be kind of robots. They're programmed here. It's like the Stepford X-Men. But Storm can't understand it. Again, she's been brainwashed. What more could they want? How could they denounce everything that makes this world good? Well, because there's no freedom. There's no freedom of choice. There's no freedom of thought. There's no connection between people. And so Jean apparently, she picked up a few names from that psychic transmission. She says En Saba Nur, which we know to be Apocalypse, Genesis, who I'm not sure who that is, and Kitty Pryde. And X-Men's response is, who the hell are they? Now, I don't know if he's putting on an act, but I mean, he seems to remember everything that came before. He seems to be the one who does. He seems to be mind wiping people that start to remember or gain knowledge, like he did with X-23. So I'm wondering if he's just playing, just pretending not to know who those people are. And that's where the first issue ends. So it definitely picks up on this issue, picks up on themes that were set forth first in the X-Men Age of X-Men Alpha story, but it takes him to a new level, very, very much more frightening. I mean, reading that, you kind of got the idea that it was kind of weird and just felt phony, like John Paul, compared it to The Truman Show. A bunch of other shows you could compare it to. I mentioned Stepford, Stepford Wives, where the wives are these programmable robot kind of people. Another one that comes to mind, another movie that you all might be familiar with is oh, now I'm drawing a blank on it. Pleasantville with Tobey Maguire, where he gets sucked inside a 1950s TV show, right? And everything is good and golly gee whiz kind of thing. That's sort of the world that X-Men has created here, but it's not reality. And again, I think that the cost, that the things that they've given up, are it's a bridge too far. And granted, I'm not a mutant. We know mutants aren't real. But if you were a mutant, is this really, you're going to give up your freedom of thought, your freedom of choice, your freedom to choose your own destiny, the ability to have love, to have relationships, to have family, brother, sister, mother, father, wife, daughter, son. You're going to give all that up? I mean, I guess if your choice is give that up or die, you might be willing to give that up. But at the end of the day, it's like, is that even really living in a way, by giving all that up and living in this fascist, oppressive society? Isn't that just as bad as being dead? I don't know. I can't answer that question. Clearly, Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson are going to try to in this series. And it'll be interesting to see what unfolds may or may not change X-Man's mind, because clearly, as I said, he appears to remember what happened before the resolution, what happened before the final events of X-Men Disassembled, but thinks that this is okay, whereas everybody else thinks it's okay because they don't know any better. So I enjoyed this issue. I thought it was a good continuation of the information that we learned in X-Men Age of Alpha. I thought the art was okay, not quite as detailed, not quite as polished as I'm used to seeing in an X-Men Marvel book. I'm not familiar with Marco Faia, so don't know if he's kind of a newer artist. But his line work is just not quite as clean or as sharp as I would like. I think his storytelling from panel to panel is fine. Backgrounds are a little light. So not my favorite art, but certainly isn't terrible art. It doesn't pull you out of the story by any stretch of the imagination. Matt Milla is a great color artist. I had no issues there. And I thought Joe Caramagna, also a very talented letterer, no issues there as well. So overall, a pretty good package. Although I will admit, after having read a lot of the other, like I haven't read all of Age of X-Men yet. I'm behind on it, but getting caught up, and I have read several of the other first issues. And I will say that this is, in a way, the least interesting of the Age of Alpha number ones. Just because I think they're trying to keep this one a little more broad and sort of use it to do the heavy lifting in terms of moving the story forward, where the other ones get to get a little more in depth with exploring the ideas that are being put forth here, the idea of autonomy, individuality, freedom of choice, that sort of thing. So this was probably my least favorite, but in no means do I think it's a bad comic. It was enjoyable. I liked it a lot, but the other ones I thought were really, really good. So this one was just a little bit behind. But again, I think it was because they're purposely trying to keep this one a little more general to try to move the story along. And if you're just going to pick up one, pick up this one, and you know you kind of are getting the kind of the broad strokes of what's happening in this world. So. What else do you have to say about this issue, John Paul? What were your thoughts on it? Did you enjoy it overall?
Overall, it was pretty good. It, like you said, it's more about laying down plot and exposition than anything for the entire event of Age of X-Men. I think the themes that it set up were important for the rest of the series that go with it. But I do think that like the interpersonal relationships are better explored in some of the other offshoots.
Yeah, I agree 100%. What did you think about the scene with X-Man and X-23 and him kind of mind wiping her?
Well, I kind of saw that coming. I, you know, he doesn't want anyone to step out of line, and he knows that once somebody starts to feel, basically have any sort of feelings, rather than just what they've been taught, that he needs to make some adjustments. And, you know, since he's omnipotent, he can do that whenever he wants.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because you know we saw at the end of the X-Men Disassembled that he supposedly was dying, and then he got that little artifact that gave him all this power and kind of was behind his omnipotence and allowed him to, you know, affect this change, and apparently allowed him to create this pocket universe. So I wonder, I mean, is he still dying? Does he just have unlimited power? Like where are we coming with that? So. Yeah.
Didn't he merge with Legion?
He did, but then they got separated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that was kind of what they all the psychic powered X-Men were able to separate those two, and then that's what allowed Jean to finally break through. Because if you remember, they couldn't even break through. They were losing the fight against the Legion X-Men hybrid. And Storm had become one of his horsemen. And then when Psylocke basically stabbed Storm through the head with the psychic dagger, when Archangel flew her up there and did that and she broke free, then Storm basically put her all into one giant lightning strike that distracted the Legion, the X-Man Legion hybrid enough that the psychic X-Men were able to separate them. And if you remember, like they separate, and Legion is laying there on the ground, and all the X-Men, like every X-Men that's ever been, every character in Marvel that's ever been an X-Men was there. They look around and they're like, where's Jean Grey? And then that's where it switches to like the, again, to borrow from the Matrix, that loading program where it's just white and we just see Jean Grey and Nate talking, where he basically explains to her, yeah, I'm dying and this artifact came to me and gave me the power and I finally wanted to do something good for once. and he apologizes to her, and then everything blinks out, and you know, Age of X-Men happens. So clearly he remembers what is going on. He's aware of the resolution. We haven't gotten as much information about exactly what sort of memories and historical events that Nate Summers, X-Man, has implanted in everybody. Like, what really is the resolution? What happened that day? Because we see in the other book we're about to talk about, Uncanny X-Men 11, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, the X-Men died that day. They're all gone. There are no more mutants. So let's go ahead and move into to that one, unless you have anything else you want to add about Marvel's X-Men number one.
Oh, nope.
All right, moving on to X-Men number 11. It's written by Matthew Rosenberg. We have art by Salvador LaRocca. Colors are by Rochelle Rosenberg. We also have a Wolverine Returns story in here that's also written by Matthew Rosenberg, but the art is by John McCrae with colors by Mike Spicer. And there's a third story also written by Matthew Rosenberg, this one with art by Juanin Ramirez with colors also by Rachel Rosenberg. And Joe Caramagna handles the letters for all the main covers, Salvador LaRocca and Rachel Rosenberg. And then we've got Luis LaRosa and Diego Rodriguez on a cover, Edward Petrovich on a cover, Alan Davis and Mark Farmer, with Chris Sotomayor on colors, Scott Williams and Brad Anderson on a cover, In Hook Lead as a cover, Ron Lim and Israel Sylvia, and then finally a Rob Liefeld and Romulo Fajardo Jr. cover. So a lot of covers to choose from. This is basically where are we now in terms of the regular Marvel Universe and where the X-Men maybe went. So we saw last time we actually had John Paul on the show, we talked about the Uncanny X-Men Annual 1, where we learned about how Cyclops came back, how he was brought back by Kid Cable, and he is at the wreckage of the X-Mansion in Central Park, just kind of thinking back, trying to find the X-Men. He's like, man, you know, you start with a simple idea. We have the right to be happy. We have the right to be safe. We have the right to exist. So in that way, I guess if you approach it with those three things, the first three things on Scott's list, that rights that mutants have, well, the world that X-Man has created, Age of X-Man, they do seem to be happy, and they are safe, and they do exist. So maybe X-Man is in the right. I don't know. I mean, I don't think he is, but you know, when you take it from that aspect, they're happy because they don't know any better, and they are safe, and they do exist. So anyway, Scott goes on to say, something hit us, you know, we get knocked down, and it turns out it's the same as always. All the stories seemed the same because we never knew the ending, right? It's anti-mutant vaccines, it's mutants being persecuted, it's people being afraid of mutants and picketing them, and government telling them they have to register, and Sentinels hunting them down. And we see that even though the senator in the X-Men disassembled storyline kind of gave up on that idea of an anti-mutant vaccine, others in the government did not. And we get a reporter saying other countries have already begun mandatory vaccinations of children. This anti-mutant vaccine basically suppresses the mutant gene so that nobody ever becomes a mutant anymore. So Scott's thinking maybe this time it's going to be different. I know that now. This could be the last X-Men story because they're gone. So as he's walking down the street, he sees some people defacing a statue of the X-Men, saying death to all mutants. And as he's walking by, he says, you know, I don't think the Worthington Foundation is going to appreciate your art, especially because you misspelled mutant. And they're like, why don't you go mind your own business? And as they get up close to him, they're like, run, it's Cyclops. And his reply is, maybe you didn't hear, kid, Cyclops is dead. So soon he's at Harry's Bar, which is a frequent X-Men establishment. And he's kind of sitting there, and it's clear he's looking for the X-Men, trying to find out where they are. And you know, he just basically says, you know, I'm looking for something that's lost. When he sees outside, there's some people hassling a girl. And he goes outside saying, you know, what? Is there a problem here? And they say, why don't you mind your own business? This girl's a mutie freak. And his response is, well, then she is my business. And he says, and they say, well, what are you, a media sympathizer or something? He says, don't use that word again. I want to make sure you remember bad decisions you made here tonight could live with you for the rest of your lives. Leave her alone. You know, just live and let live. And, of course, they're not going to go for that. So they attack him, and he basically kicks their butts. And we see that the girl they were harassing is Blindfold, who I am not familiar with at all. Apparently, she's a mutant who can see the future, but she can't always determine what is the future and what is the present. And she, and I'm sure this is purposeful, she is very hard to understand. Like, her sentences don't make sense in terms of, you know, here's nouns and here's verbs and here's, you know, other parts of language. Here's the subject, here's the predicate. Like, it just doesn't make sense sometimes. So, she kind of responds to something Scott said inside about having lost something, and that's what he's looking for, which is the X-Men. And she says, you didn't lose something. Something lost you, Mr. Summers. And that's when Cyclops realizes, oh, Blindfold, Ruth, my God, what are you? She says, I'm looking for you. And he says, why don't we go? And then again, she's answering, like, before he, that's another part of why she's so hard to understand. Before you can even get your sentence out, she's already answering. Says, no, thank you, I'll stay out here. So obviously he was going to say, why don't we go inside? But she's already answering before he can even finish the sentence. She says, I came here because I needed to talk to you, Mr. Summers. Talk. And then he's like, well, how did you find me? Oh, right, sorry, you know, you can see the future. You're a seer. And she says, I didn't want to, please, but I thought you'd want to know. Thank you. So, like, what is she? Again, it's like, is she just speaking in riddles or is she answering, you know, thoughts in his head? Right? So we're kind of lost because we don't get all of the conversation. And she tells him they're dead. I see things and they're all dead. So she can't even apparently sense the X-Men in this other world. But she's there because she says, nothing's ever going to be the same. Don't do what you're going to do because the mistakes we make now will follow us even in death, even back. This is forever. And she says, I have to go now. Leave some money for the window now. And we're like, wait, what window? What are you talking about? And he says, wait, Ruth, don't go. And before he can say anything else, he's tackled from behind by one of the guys that he had that was harassing Ruth or Blindfold before. And as he starts to tackle Scott throws him through the window. So that's what she was talking about. She said, leave some money for the window now. So again, she just, like, the way she talks and the way she doesn't realize what's present, what's future, it makes her a very hard character to understand. So by the time Scott throws the guy through the window and turns around, she's gone, and he doesn't know what to do. So he decides to seek out Ben Urich. And he's like, Scott Summers, is that you? How are you? What is how, you know, I thought you were dead. You know, the world thought Cyclops was dead. How can he be back? And Cyclops says, I'll make you a deal. I'll answer your questions if you answer mine. He's like, well, you know, what can I help you with? He's like, finding the X-Men. And Ben's like, look, you know, I want to help you. We all look for the X-Men when they disappeared. Nobody could find them. You know, your life might have been easier if you stayed dead, because all of a sudden this world is they're against mutants again, and certainly they're going to be against Mr. Angry Mutant, which is who you were before you left. But at this point, I think you just have to accept it. The X-Men are dead. Well, we know Scott's never going to accept that. He's never going to accept that the X-Men are dead, but he decides to drown his sorrows, apparently. Six beers and one bottle of whiskey later, he's in Hell's Kitchen. He's on a roof. He's throwing empty bottles up in the air and zapping them with his optic blast. When Jamie Madrox shows up and says, is that you? How'd you find me? He's like, well, you're firing off these giant red strobe lights in the sky for over an hour. He's like, I'm actually shocked the Avengers haven't showed up yet. So Cyclops is like, well, I'm glad you're here. You know, you're great at helping track down mutants. You know, why don't you help me out? I said, well, you and half the governments are trying to track down mutants. But look, I'm sorry, Scott. They're gone. Every mutant I know got killed. They got locked up. They got deported. They went underground, except the ones that were already underground, like the Morlocks. So it's, you know, it's time. It's time to just let it go. But he does agree that he'll see what he can do. He'll try to help Scott out. He doesn't make any promises. But he says, all right, Scott, you need some money. Scott's like, yeah, I could use a few hundred. This is actually a pretty cool scene. So Jamie pulls out you know, $100 and he's holding his hand, and then he duplicates himself. And I didn't know that this was a thing, but apparently when he duplicates himself holding the money, all the money gets duplicated as well. So I guess it's technically, I mean, the legality of that, I mean, obviously Scott's not going to worry about it. But so if you duplicate it, they're going to have all the same serial numbers. So technically it's not real money because they don't have unique serial numbers. But it's not really counterfeit either because it's, you know, made from the right paper. And anyway, I just thought it was interesting. Most people probably don't give it a second thought, but, you know, I'm weird like that. So I did think about those sort of things like, oh, is that really legal what he's doing? Not that he would care necessarily. So his next visit is to the Morlocks in the sewers. He's, again, just looking for help. I'm trying to find the X-Men. Can you help me out? And the Morlocks don't want to have anything to do with it. It's like, you know, why don't you tell me where the hell your precious X-Men were when the world came down here and they were dragging our people away over the last month? Where were you? Why should we help you? Chambers shows up and he's kind of the same way. He's like, you know, you lead the X-Men in the war against the Avengers, the Inhumans, anyone who looks at you wrong. You make the world hate us and then you die and now you're back and you want us to help you? Nah, man. Like, take off. We got our own problems. So it doesn't look like Scott's going to get any help from the Morlocks. So he heads to Central Park. This is the spot where the Xavier Institute, the X-Mansion, was. And he's kind of hanging out, trying to decide what to do next when Jamie shows up again with several of his duplicates. And he knows that things didn't go well in the sewers, but he did find the address of Blindfold, of Ruth. And he said, she's hiding, Scott, she's hiding. But I did what you asked, I found her. Scott's hoping to talk to her again and get some answers. But Jamie's like, you know what? I don't really care what you're going over there for. What you need to do is leave the girl alone. That's my advice to you. So, and he does, he has a really good line here after he says, leave the girl alone. He says, nothing good ever came from Scott Summers being involved, which is true. But in a way, it's sad that that's where we've gotten to with Cyclops. Because John Paul and I talked extensively about Cyclops and who he is as a character when we covered that annual about him coming back. And even though we said it wasn't going to be a Cyclops spotlight and it didn't cover his early years in depth, it did cover his recent past. And it's just strange that that's where he's come from. And the state of the world and the state of how they treat mutants right now kind of prevents any celebration of Scott being back, right? Like if Jean were there and Nightcrawler and Colossus and like the regular group Scott being back from the dead, they, you know, would be cause for celebration. Here it's cause for nobody wants to have anything to do with Scott, basically because he was such a jerk when he died and in the you know, couple previous years with the things he was doing. Like, you know, you roll the clock back before all that, before Avengers versus X-Men, and you would never hear somebody saying nothing ever good came from Scott Summers being involved. He was a hero, and clearly he is not so much a hero anymore. So we do get a flash of Ruth in the tub saying this is forever, and it looks like the water is blood. Like, I'm not sure if we're supposed to think that she killed herself or somebody killed her. But apparently something bad has happened because all we get in that panel other than this picture of Ruth in the bathtub is Scott saying, what did they do? No, Ruth, what did you do? So again, not sure. Clearly she appears to be dead. But is it suicide? Was it somebody that killed her? We just don't know. So meanwhile, on the next page, Empire State University, we have the senator who picked up for Senator Allen, Senator Prestel, who says that she knows that Senator Allen had a change of heart, but it's more important than ever now. There's so many of these genetic abnormalities. We need to prevent that. We need to have this vaccine. And it's basically an anti-mutant rally. And somebody calls out, Miss Prestel, what do you have to say to the families whose mutant children have been killed by the government? What do you have to say to the families who've been deported? And she replies, oh, I see we have a mutant lover in the crowd. This kind of thing, this rally, this depiction of hate and divisiveness. It's nothing new in terms of, you know, mutant rights versus human rights in the Marvel Universe. But I got to tell you, the current state of the political climate in the United States, this sort of thing strikes way too close to home. You know, he's asking a legitimate question, and her response is immediately to attack him. Oh, I see we have a mutant lover in the crowd. You know what I say to those families? You know, how about your child didn't kill any of his classmates today? What sort of private army is your child joining? And, you know, she just stokes the fires. And unfortunately, like I said, this rings all too true. This story is, you know, 2 years old. This came out in 2018 or 2019. But it's more true today than ever. So before Scott can even remove himself from the crowd, because that's who was calling out to this Senator Prestel, he's being attacked from all sides by these humans, being called a beauty lover, being cussed out. His glasses are knocked off his face, which we know the Ruby Quartz glasses are what keep his optic blasts from firing. And they're saying, what's that glowing? And he tells them, stay away from me. And he starts firing his mutant blasts. And then Captain America shows up saying, that's enough. Close your eyes, Summers. That's better. You drop these, and gives him back his glasses. And Captain America says, welcome back. I wish we were meeting under better circumstances. And Scott has a great response, which is 100% true. He's like, there are no better circumstances for people like me these days. And again, Captain America is just trying to, you know, trying to deflect, trying to make it sound like it's not as bad as you know, it could be. Oh, these are trying times. And he's like, look, I think that depends on how you look at it, because you told me once you regretted not doing more for mutants. You remember that? But you know, I just came back and I find out that mutants are being hunted and driven to extinction again. And here you are, with draped in the American flag as always, in the middle of a hate rally. And again, Captain America trying to, you know, oh, not my fault. Oh, that's not fair. I'm just here to make sure people don't get hurt. Captain America holds weight. He could be lending the voice of reason to these people who, I'm sorry, are hate mongers, who don't want to live in harmony. They just want to dislike and destroy and shout down anybody who's different from them. Again, not that different from the political climate that we're in right now, red versus blue. So Scott responds to that by saying, your people, you mean, because you sure didn't do that for mine. You know, you didn't make sure any mutants were hurt. And he says, well, whatever happened to the X-Men, you know, I'm sorry. But look, I should have done more, but I don't know what you're hoping to accomplish here. And he's like, well, listen, there's a person on the stage that's endorsing the end of my race to a cheering crowd. And I wanted to see it with my own two eyes. I wanted to challenge to its face. And I thought you, of anybody, would understand standing up to fascism. And again, Captain America, like, I don't know, man, it doesn't really seem like Rosenberg really gets Captain America, or maybe he does, and that's the whole point of what he's trying to get across. It's such a tough situation for Captain America to be in. It's like, you're in a crowd of angry people surrounded by police snipers. This wasn't an act of protest, it was a suicide attempt. But again, Captain America himself has said in the past, I haven't done enough, and here he is not doing anything, you know, other than he makes sure Cyclops is not arrested. And he does try to say to Cyclops, hey, let's go somewhere and talk. And I love Cyclops' reaction. He's like, F you, Rogers. And Captain America, again, trying to play the peacemaker. This isn't what you want the cameras to see. He's like, no, I want them to see it, because you want the real story. I want them to see reality, not your Captain America always playing the peacemaker, glasses half full kind of thing. It's, in a way here, Captain America, as much as he's a symbol for, you know, American ideals, I almost think in this context of this story, he's a symbol of white privilege. You know, here he is, a white guy in America, in the current environment that we're living in. He's a superhero. He has powers, but he's not a mutant. I'm not sure what it is about him that means that he's allowed to wield his power responsibly, but Cyclops isn't. Cyclops gets attacked for wanting to defend other mutants. Captain America says, I wish I'd done more for mutants. He doesn't get attacked. He doesn't get called a mutie lover. So again, he definitely is a symbol of kind of non-mutant / white privilege here. But Cyclops goes on to tell the camera, promise me that you'll broadcast this unedited. I want the world to see it. He says, I'm Cyclops, leader of the X-Men. If there's any X-Men out there still, now's the time where people need you. I need you. In 2 nights' time, I'll return to where it all began. Come find me. So anybody who's previously a member of the X-Men is going to know that's Westchester, Salem Center, upstate New York, the site previously of the X-Mansion. And he's obviously hoping for some allies, hoping for some other X-Men to show up so they can try to find the missing X-Men. But instead, Donald Pearson, the Reavers show up, the Purifiers show up, the Sapien League shows up, and they all say they're here to finish this. You're going to die, Summers. And he says, all right, you know, probably, but at least I'm going to take a lot of you with me. And Donald Pierce says, well, what's it like knowing you failed, knowing your friends are all dead, the world doesn't care, and you're going to die all alone? And then we get a voice off panel saying, he ain't alone. And that sound snicked, and it's Wolverine. So Wolverine jumps down out of the tree saying this is going to be fun. And him and Cyclops basically beat the crap out of these guys who are, you know, they're not in the league of Cyclops and Logan. It would have been interesting to see if Cyclops could have handled it alone. But having somebody to watch his back, they were no match for Logan and Wolverine. They're just not in the same league. When I was reading this, you know, once they're all down, once all the foes are defeated and laying at the feet of Cyclops and Logan, Cyclops says, Logan? To which Wolverine responds, Slim? And there was a part of me, I wanted them to reconcile right there. I wanted them to hug. Here's two guys that not too long ago were dead. They've obviously shared a very acrimonious history, but they've also shed blood together in battle many, many times. And I just once wanted there to be an acknowledgement of the fact that, in a way, they're like brothers, you know? I just thought it would have been really great. And you almost see that there's a moment where they consider it, because they're facing away from each other as they say each other's name, and then they turn toward each other and they just kind of get a measure of each other. And I'm just like, just give each other a hug. Just give, even if it's that bro hug. But instead, Logan turns away and says, now that we're all caught up, let's go. So I guess some things never change. And they really are caught up right back to where they've always been, in terms of they don't really get along. They don't really like each other. They have fundamental differences in ideals. Although you would think, with the way Cyclops behaved in the last couple of years of his life, becoming so militant, that it definitely seemed like he was more Wolverine-like than ever before, in terms of punch people first and ask questions later. But apparently Logan still sees him as the goody-goody. So that's it. Logan starts walking away saying, we got work to do, and it's to be continued. That's the first story. So good start. If the X-Men were missing and you had to have two people search for them, I think of any two X-Men, Logan and Cyclops are probably the best two. Logan, because he's great at finding people with his senses, and you know, he intimidates people into giving him information, and you know, he just has that knack. He's been around the block. Cyclops, because he'll never give up. He's got that undeniable willpower that if there's any chance, as long as there's breath in his body, Scott Summers will keep searching for the X-Men. Of that, there's no doubt. So I think this is the two perfect X-Men to search for the rest, to search for the missing X-Men. How they're going to find them in that X-Man universe, completely up in the air. Don't have any idea. Haven't read any of this iteration of the Uncanny X-Men series beyond issue 11, so can't wait to see where it goes. The art by Salvador LaRocca. He's an incredible artist, one of the most talented working at Marvel these days. Love the payouts, page layouts especially, especially the fact that he doesn't use, you know, traditional panels. It's not all squares and rectangles. He'll break things up with diagonal lines and do other kind of things. And yeah, I thought this was a great start. The only thing that I didn't like, and I can't even say for sure that I didn't like about it, it just made me a little uncomfortable, was that Captain America scene. But I think maybe that was the point, that here we are with one of the most iconic heroes of the Marvel Universe, Captain America, and even he can't relate, because he has that privilege that I mentioned that he may not even be aware of. And even he has expressed regret in the past for not doing enough for the mutants, but yet they're all gone. And maybe he didn't have the opportunity to do anything, but he certainly could have done more for for Cyclops at that point. He didn't speak out in favor of Cyclops to the crowd. So, again, it was uncomfortable, didn't like it, but I think that was the point. So that's the first story in Uncanny X-Men 11. I'm going to cover the other two stories really briefly, but I want to give John Paul a chance to talk about this issue. What were your thoughts, John Paul?
I found it interesting that you pointed out when Jamie multiplied and he multiplied the money too. I was like, wait, I was thinking about it. How is that possible? I thought he just, you know, multiplied himself. I didn't know that he can multiply different objects. Well, I never considered the legality of it. Definitely is like, I don't think he cares if it's counterfeit or not.
He probably doesn't. But I mean, he does always when he copies himself, he's not naked. His clothes get copied too. So I guess it makes sense.
That's true.
Something that, you know, is really close to him could be. But it does open up a whole crazy idea of possibility. I mean, what if he's holding diamonds in his hand? Can he just, I mean, this guy could be like the richest guy in the world. So yeah, interesting. But anyway, go.
I mean, he really can. Even if he didn't multiply valuable objects, he just could work several different jobs.
That's true.
Get so much money, you know? But I digress. I enjoyed this story. I think that you're right that the two X-Men characters to go looking for the rest of them, it definitely is Cyclops and Wolverine. Wolverine, undoubtedly the most popular X-Man. And he has the skills to find almost every anybody who is traceable. And the fact that they both pretty much came back to life around the same time. That shared experience is like, I'm back, but I have no family to come back to. So I have to go looking for my family, and my family is the X-Men. So I definitely think that was a good idea to put them two together. And like you said, I wish they, you know, just like a handshake at least, you know, not just stand there and act like we just didn't beat up or kill these guys for nothing, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting too because it does sort of. I mean, we know Logan cares, and the second story is all about that. One thing about the second story, so the art is by John McCrae. I think most people will know him from his work on the Hitman series over at DC with Garth Ennis. His art style is just—it's not my favorite. He's not the cleanest artist, but the second story is all about how much Wolverine clearly does care. I mean, you can take it one of two ways. Maybe Wolverine doesn't care about Cyclops. You know, he's a teammate. He's a means to an end. Wolverine wants to find the missing X-Men as well, and he knows Cyclops can help with that. But what we see is basically this is a story. The second story is a story that sort of mirrors the events of what Cyclops is going through in the first story, but it's giving us sort of a behind the scenes look. So all along, as Cyclops was doing his thing and looking for the X-Men and doing whatever he needed to do, Wolverine was there watching his back. So we see Wolverine Returns, name of the story. He's looking at Cyclops saying, "You're sloppy, old man. You're going to get yourself killed again." And there's a sniper on a building that is doing exactly that, is about to kill Cyclops before Wolverine takes him out. Later we see that, and I'm not going to say who the sniper is because it gets into a whole thing that we'll probably talk about on the next episode when we get into, when we have a better idea of what exactly is going on. But we then see that Wolverine is the one that went and talked to Jamie Madrox, and he's the reason that Jamie Madrox showed up and was able to find Blindfold and send Blindfold out to find Cyclops. We see that Wolverine went into the sewers, into the Morlock sewers, and defeated a bunch of armed and armored guys who were searching for Cyclops and would have taken him out in the sewers. we see that Wolverine talked to Blindfold and tried to get some answer for her and said, go seek out Scott. You know, he needs you right now. Wolverine was at the rally, and the only reason he didn't step in is because he saw that Captain America would. So all along, as Scott's going through the first story, we see that Wolverine always had his back, to the point where he ends up in the trees in Salem Center, Westchester, drinking a beer, basically waiting for his moment. And then when he sees Cyclops is super outnumbered, he makes his move. And he always had Cyclops back. So again, it just seemed a little strange that it wasn't a something. There wasn't a handshake, like Jean-Paul said, or a hug or some kind of acknowledgement, like at least a good to see you. The last story is called The Last Blindfold Story. And this one's basically about Ruth. And it's some background on her and kind of what she's gone through for the past couple years. And to be honest with you, I didn't really get much out of this story. I'm not really sure what the purpose of it is. Maybe we'll have more insight into it after we've read some more. But apparently she sees something bad coming, including her own end. She says, I'm running out of future. And as much as Jamie tries to help her, whoever tries to help her, she seems resigned to her fate. So she says, you know, my gift is seeing the future, and my curse is knowing I no longer have one. So who killed her, and why did she kill herself? Like, I'm just not sure. It almost feels like this last story is put in here just to, I don't want to say it's put in here to confuse us, but that's all it did for me. Especially because, as I said, she doesn't speak in a way that's easy to understand, because sometimes she's replying to people's thoughts that they haven't even expressed, and we're not privy to those. And so, yeah, I'm not sure what the purpose of this last story was. I'm hoping it'll make more sense as I continue reading. But I thought the art was done really well. I'm a fan of Juan and Ramirez, and we'll talk about that. I think I did talk about that already when I talked about X-Force number one. He did the backup story for that, about Boom Boom. And I like his style. I think it suits X-Force a lot better than the main artist, Dylan Burnett, on the first couple issues. So great art, great color work. Rochelle Rosenberg did the colors for all the stories. She's spectacular. She's a superstar when it comes to color work. So yeah, I wasn't blown out of the water by this last story. It was left me a little confused. Although I did like the second one, the fact that Logan was shadowing Cyclops the whole time and had his back the whole time. I thought that was great as well. Anything you want to add about these last two stories, Jean-Paul?
You know, it's been a while since I've read stories about the Morlocks. I've never heard of one of these mutants, Velocidad. I think that's how he said it. I never heard of him. I don't know if you had heard of him before.
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. That, and I'm kind of confused. What does Callisto have a power?
She is a mutant, but I cannot for the life of me remember what her power is.
Neither can I.
I'll look at
it. I think of it. I mean, like, I recognize her when I think of the Morlocks. That's the first one I think of, but what is her power?
I'm looking it up right now. Callisto. History. Enhanced sight, including night vision. Enhanced hearing, enhanced smell, taste, and touch. Coupled with moderate degrees of enhanced conditioning, such as superhuman strength, speed, agility. It has also been suggested that her mutant power grants her tactical brilliance that allows her to see the best way to engage in any conflict. So basically, it just sounds like she has enhanced senses. A little bit of super strength, speed, agility. So, certainly not to any kind of Wolverine level.
Right.
Just a little bit better than everybody else. But she's always been...
Well, Wolverine doesn't have night vision.
Oh, that's true. She's always been kind of boring in my mind and always super whiny. I've never really liked her as a character. But I think that's kind of her purpose. I think she, you know, she is a great advocate for her people, that's for sure.
That's true. But yeah, I kind of like the art in both of the back half stories. More than the main artist, Salvador La Roca, to be honest.
Really?
In
the last story, the Juan and Ramirez?
Both of them. Really? Who's the artist before him?
John McCrae is the one that did the...
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Dennis Cowan.
Okay, I can see that.
A little bit. And I like that style. I mean, I don't think that style fits all different stories, but I do enjoy it sometimes.
Did you have any thoughts about the fact that Wolverine was there kind of guarding Cyclops' back the whole time?
When I first read it, I was a little surprised by that. I didn't know that he would be looking after the guy that he doesn't like, but when there's nobody else left, who are you going to look for, you know?
Yeah, I guess. I guess that's true. Maybe he does realize that even the great Wolverine, you know, he's better with Cyclops' help than without. And then the last story, were you just as confused as I was, or did you think it was?
From the beginning, just as you said, I don't understand the character all that well. And she's moderately interesting, but I didn't really know how to decipher it either. But one thing is in the very back page, in the little square, is a suicide prevention hotline thing in the comic. So I'm pretty sure she committed suicide.
That's a good point. Yeah, suicide hotline. Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar. That's the thing. I'm not familiar with Blindfold. I mean, it may have been that's something that she's struggled with, like, all along. So I don't know. I'd have to ask Matthew Rosenberg, or maybe we'll just keep reading and it'll become self-evident when we continue. So yeah, definitely interesting where we are right now with the X-Men in terms of these two different narratives. We've got the Uncanny X-Men title, which is going to continue to show us Cyclops and Wolverine searching for the X-Men, while we've got the Age of X-Men titles, the miniseries, and the two bookend issues giving us that narrative over there about that alternate universe, all leading into, as we know, House of X, Powers of X, and subsequently Dawn of X. So that is one advantage of Marvel kind of slowing down their publishing right now with the pandemic that's going on. It's given us a chance to get caught up. So I hope you enjoyed us talking about these couple of issues of X-Men. We'll get another X-Men Tuesday out soon. Next time we'll be talking about Next Gen number 1. As well as X-Force number 2, which is I'm surprised how much I'm enjoying X-Force. Well, only because I just can't remember ever enjoying an X-Force title as much as I enjoy this one. But at the same time, it's interesting. I read the credits to see who, you know, is responsible for these books, and then I start reading them, and then I get 3 or 4 pages in, and I'm so engrossed in the story, I forget, wait, who wrote this? Whose art is this? And I end up having to flip back, because I'm enjoying it so much. And man, I'm telling you, when it comes to X books, it's always Ed Brisson. I'm always like, oh, it's Ed Brisson. No wonder I like it so much. The guy's just one of the best X-Men writers out there, bar none. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like Matthew Rosenberg. I think Lee Williams. There's a lot of, you know, Benjamin Percy. Obviously, Jonathan Hickman has great ideas. But man, when it comes to the actual nuts and bolts, dialogue, breaking things down, panel to panel, telling a great story, man, Ed Brisson, he may be one of the most underrated writers working in comics right now. He is so, so, so good. So that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.